Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all them. Gotta use it only if necessary. Homie, vestige is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. Was when my mom said, again, you could be Christ. I wasn't old enough to hold my D&P right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The army's a school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick's Hill. For fish gills, a cop, none. The time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Up the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Just know my face, I be the case. But the wish at the police, they'll get the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey
Newton. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. Of what we fight for, my heart goes to you, beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer.
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
You have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today.
him with irons.
Starring Gary Dordan from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Free of land, real distributed ingredients. I'm your host, Bumani Hero Jihad Secure, a Georgia University Radio. First, our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional illiteracy among new African black prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transform the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of the new African community. Our fifth goal is to prepare a new African prisoner for release, producing new African citizens. Before I bring on the guests, I'll let go of a couple of events that happened during the week in history. On May the 3rd, 1845, Macon B. Allen was the first black lawyer admitted to the bar had examination at Worcester, Massachusetts. Also on May the 3rd, 1898, Septimus Clark, civil rights activist and educator, was born. Also on May the 3rd, 1948, the Supreme Court ruled in Shelley v. Cramer that federal and state courts could not enforce restrictive covenants that barred persons from owning or occupying property because of their race. Also on May the 3rd, 1968, black students seized finance building at Northwestern University demanding black oriented curriculum and campus reform. On May the 4th, 1891, Providence Hospital and Training School, first black owned and controlled hospital in the U.S., opened on the south side of Chicago, established by black surgeon Dinah Hale Williams. Also on May the 4th, 1897, Joseph Smith patented the lawn sprinkler. Also on May the 4th, 1961, 13 Freedom Riders began a bus trip through the South. Also on May the 4th, 1970, Ohio National Guard opened fire on student protesters at Kent State, killing four people. Also on May the 4th, 1973, New Jersey Turnpike, Bob Sinder Dakota was captured, and we know the sister, Mama Side Security, is still liberated to this day. Okay, on May the 5th, 1905, the first issue of Chicago Defender was published by Robert Abbott. Also on May the 5th, 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks, who was a poetess, she won the Pulitzer Prize. Also on May the 5th, 1971, a riot in Brownsville section, New York took place. And today, dated March the 6th, 1787, the African Lodge number 459 organized in Boston for Prince Hall of Master. It was less than a month after the founding of the Free African Society, and the two events, one occurred in Philadelphia, the other in Boston, testified to a powerful leap in group consciousness. Also on today, in 1812, Martin Delaney, who was born free, was a noted anti-slave activist, writer, and physician, a black national born. Also on today, in 1922, Lloyd Richardson, civil rights activist, was born. Also on today, in 1960, President Eisenhower signed the Civil Rights Act in 1960. Also on today date, in 1967, Aretha Franklin released Atlanta album containing the hit song R-E-S-P-E-T. Okay, on May the 7th, 1867, black demonstrators staged riot to protest segregation on New Orleans street cars. Similar demonstrations occurred in Mobile, Alabama, and other cities. Also on May the 7th, 1885, Dr. John E.W. Thompson, graduate of Yale University Medical School, named Minister to Haiti. Also on May the 7th, 1925, Department of Negro Literature and History, now the Schomburg Center, opened at 135th Street branch of New York City, New York Public Library. Also on May the 7th, 1946, William H. Hastie inaugurated as the first black governor of the Virgin Islands. Also on May the 7th, 1961, riding to protest segregation in New Orleans, 1961. Okay, on May the 8th, 1858, John Brown held an anti-slavery convention attended by 12 white, 34 black at Chatham, Canada. Also on May the 8th, 1915, Henry McNeil Turner, the first black chaplain in the U.S. Army, and A.M.E. Bishop died in Windsor, Ontario at the age of 82. Also on May the 8th, 1926, A. Philip Randolph organized the Black Union of Railroad Reporters, significant step toward getting blacks to join unions. On May the 9th, 1800, Abolition John Brown were born. Also on May the 9th, 1862, three generals organized black regiments without the approval of the Lincoln administration. Black David Hunter began organizing the first South Carolina Volunteers, the first black regiment, on May the 9th. Jim Lane started organizing the first Kansas Colored Volunteers in August, and Ben Butler issued a call to the Free Blacks in New Orleans on August 22nd. Also, on May 9, 1862, General David Hunter issued a proclamation freeing the slaves of Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina rebels. Lincoln revoked the proclamation on May 19, returning some 1 million blacks to slavery. You know, it's a lot of things happening in history, but that's just a few things happening in history during this week. I want to thank everybody who listened to our broadcast. I want to thank all the people who are currently educating themselves and doing productive things in the community, who will better themselves on all levels. And I would like, with all to do, I had to bring on to the show tonight, Sister Atlantis Broder. How you doing, Sister?
I'm doing good, Brother Bomani. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Before we get started, can you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I currently reside in Maryland, born and raised in D.C. and Maryland, but I have been very fortunate to grow up in a household with my father, who has introduced me to African history and culture at a very early age. And one of the things that I've been most grateful about is having the opportunity to travel to make my first trip to Africa at the age of 7. I traveled to Egypt for about 15 days, and that was my first real introduction to aspects of ancient African history. And so that really kind of led me on a path to, one, be inspired to learn more about who I am, but also to want to follow my father's footsteps. And so a few years later, I did write a second book, Africa on My Mind, Reflections of My Second Trip to Africa, about my journeys to Ghana, Senegal, Gambia, and the Ivory Coast. So just, you know, being able to make a connection between our history before slavery and what happened to our ancestors when we were brought from Africa, stolen from Africa and brought to numerous places around the world. But those books, writing those books, gave me the opportunity to begin doing lectures at a young age, visiting schools, churches, and other community organizations, just teaching our people the truth about African history, at least from the perspective of a young African-American female. So I've been very fortunate to be able to stay on that path and be able to support my father and the work that he's been doing over the last, 30-something years. And I'm sure we'll definitely get into more details as we talk tonight. But I can definitely speak to my greatest passion, which is education. I taught actually 5th through 12th grade over the course of about 10 years. I really learned to develop a great amount of appreciation for educators and what they had to do to help prepare the next generation of young people. And so decided to go down that path, and that's also been beneficial to me in my journey of helping to, teach people who we are as people of African descent. So that's a brief summary.
Okay. True indeed. That's a good summary. The first thing I want to ask you is about what is your name?
So my first name is Atlantis, like what people refer to as the lost city of Atlantis or the lost continent. And my middle name is Tai'i. So my first name was given to me by my father around that time. So I was born in 82. So around that time, my father was just becoming coming into this knowledge, learning about Asa Hilliard and John Jackson and John Henry Clark. And so he read John Jackson's book, Introduction to Civilization, and he learned about the continent of Atlantis and that being an influence or potentially being the primary source of the knowledge that we now see, you know, had flourished in ancient Kemet for thousands of years. And so he was very fascinated about the history of Atlantis and decided to give me that name. Initially, he kind of looked at Atlantis as one of the first or earliest civilizations. So me at the time, being his first child, felt that it was most appropriate. And then having an interest in Egyptian history and culture, the name Ta'i being named after Queen T, and also was interesting about my name, more specifically my initials, is that my initials are ATB, and it's the same initials as my father. And so he was very strategic in giving me my name, but also sharing the same initials to kind of invoke, you know, energy around the name. So that's kind of the short and sweet of it.
True indeed, true indeed. Can you tell a little bit more about your work with the Children Defense Fund Freedom School Program?
Well, actually, I first, technically, I first became involved in Freedom School back in, what was that, 2001. As a child, I actually had traveled to, I guess it was Tennessee, but wherever my father had been doing trainings. For this this national training for the Children's Defense Fund. But I formally became involved in 2001 as a teenager, and so I served as a what they refer to as a SLI or Servant Leader Intern. And so the Children's Defense Fund does a variety of things specifically for our people, but also people who are living in poverty. But one of their most popular and I guess even more successful programs has been Freedom School. And Freedom School was actually based off of or modeled after the 1964 Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And so essentially during that summer for about 6 weeks, college students from up north came down to Mississippi to educate African Americans. And, of course, that's, you know, part of the, an ongoing struggle in terms of using education to liberate our people. But, of course, down south and particularly during those times, during the 60s, most of our people are working as sharecroppers. And so Freedom School went down to the south to kind of counter that sharecropper education. So for 6 weeks, they provided opportunities for students, their parents, and even grandparents to learn how to read, to practice reading, writing, and civic engagement. And that's actually a big part that the new model of Freedom School kind of harps on, civic engagement, empowering people through the political process. So the Freedom School that I became a part of was actually started in 1990, I think about 1995 or 1993, by Marion Wright Edelman, who is the founder of the Children's Defense Fund. And so she, you know, has done a lot of work. She's a lawyer, among other things, but has done a lot of work with some major players on the civil rights movement. And so she was inspired to bring this program back, and so that's what she did years ago, and it's still standing strong. They have they've served what I think over at least 150,000 young people between kindergarten and 12th grade since 95, and then the college students that are working with these young people at this program, they actually have to go to Tennessee for 1 week for a national training at the Alex Haley Farm. And so during this training is when these college students are becoming familiar with the Freedom School curriculum and obviously with the civil rights movement, so they have some context and can bring that information to their respective sites, Freedom School sites. So, yeah, it's actually Freedom School is what inspired me to go into the classroom and actually become an educator. So Freedom School has definitely taught me a lot about the civil rights movement. And, you know, I started off as an intern for a couple years. I did that. Then I had an opportunity to become an Ella Baker trainer. So we're, you know, named after civil rights leader Ella Baker, who was a part of SNCC. She was a part of helping to create Freedom School. And so after becoming an Ella Baker trainer, then I eventually went on to become a site coordinator and working at my own, running my own Freedom School sites. So I've had a lot of, I've been fortunate through Freedom School to have a lot of gain, to have gained a lot of experience, you know, not just learning about our history, but also how to run an effective reading enrichment program. So that's been very helpful with the work that my father and I have been doing for some years now.
Okay. Can you tell them more about the Asa Restoration Project and your excavation, the excavation on the tomb of Karakamon?
Yes. So the Asa Restoration Project was started by my father in 2008, and the project is named in honor of Asa G. Hilliard III, who is a well-known educator and historian, and he lived in Atlanta and served that community. And actually, really, he's known across the country and around the world because he's been around for a while, and actually is my father's jegna or mentor. My father believes that it's important to keep the memory, keep people's memory alive, especially those who you respect and have played an important role in your life. So he decided to, you know, got permission from the family, name the project after Asa Hilliard. And this project came about as a result of him during one of his study tours to Egypt, was introduced to a Russian Egyptologist by the name of Alina Pisikova. And so at the time that my father met Dr. Alina, I think she had been excavating for a couple of years, but had, essentially we had run out of funds. And she was excavating or attempting to locate the remains of 25th Dynasty tombs. But she had, you know, essentially run out of money. Her colleagues were not interested in funding her. And they essentially told her, you know, you need to leave this alone. These aren't your people. And so what's really significant about the 25th Dynasty is that this is the only dynasty that traditional Egyptologists recognize as being African, as being dark-skinned. And so, of course, that implies that the previous dynasties were non-African. But we, so over the course of the last, 12 years since we've been excavating, we've been able to find, even though we know that the original people of Kemet were African, we've been able to find evidence to help support what we already know. You know, so, yeah, so basically once my father met Elena and realized that she was not, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, your average Egyptologist, but really respected, you know, the African contribution to history, and was not going to, she was honest about her work. And so she acknowledged that African people are the origins of Kemet, and that was her route, and so her colleagues were not willing to support that. But my father, upon meeting her, recognized her passion and commitment, and decided to step up as the primary funder. And so, for the last 12 years, we've become the first African Americans to fund an active archaeological dig in Kemet. And not only are we doing that, but we're also providing opportunities for our people to actually come and work at the excavation site and get their hands dirty, you know, be a part of making history. So the tomb that we're currently, we'll be done excavating, we're done excavating, but the restoration process will be complete in about 3-4 years. We plan to open the site in 2023. So the site that we're opening to the public in 2023 belongs to a man by the name of Karakamon, who was known as a priest and he was responsible for pouring libation at one of the temples in Kemet. And so tomb is one that will be open to the public, but there are at least two other tombs that we're also excavating. And so I'm very appreciative. One, I'm very proud of my dad and, you know, the work that he's put in over the past 12 years. It's been very challenging. There's been many times that he wanted to give up, but he remembered his purpose and why he was doing it, and it's definitely paid off. So, you know, I'm really proud of him, but I'm also very appreciative of all of the people who have been supportive of us, who have either donated, who have contributed financially, or who have traveled to Egypt with us to actually work at the site. So we've been successful because the people in the community recognize the work that we're doing and have been able to support us the past 12 years. So that's the Acer Restoration Project.
Yes, ma'am. I understand you're the vice president of IKG Cultural Resources. IKG Cultural Resources. What exactly is the IKG Cultural Resource? What exactly is that? What is it for?
So it's actually the name of a business that my father started during the late 80s, and it originally stood for the Institute of Karmic Guidance, and as my father, you know, after he had written his first book and was becoming more known by people in our community, he noticed that there were some people who, although they had an interest in learning about their history, they would kind of see certain words or hear certain words, and because they maybe lacked knowledge, they wouldn't necessarily respond favorable or might be turned off. So just, you know, for example, the word karmic or karma. So I feel that now, you know, in 2020, you know, if anybody talks about karma, it's pretty simple. But back then, it was, you know, tended to be something that kind of, that might have turned some people off. And so what we decided to do was use the acronym still IKG, but information plus knowledge equals growth. And so through IKG, the last 20-plus years, of course, we have written, between my dad and I, have written a number of publications about African and African-American history and culture. Through IKG, we also do Egypt or the Potomac Field Trips of D.C., and we take people around the city, around Washington, D.C., for about three and a half hours, and we show them how the founding fathers of this country incorporated more specifically Egyptian history, culture, spirituality, symbolism, and architecture into designing the nation's capital. So, of course, now with the health crisis going on, we've had to postpone them, but hopefully we'll be able to resume before the end of the season in November. But if not, you know, we'll prepare for 2021 season, which will begin in April.
Okay. You talked about how can an individual get involved? Or how can an individual participate and get involved in that field trip?
Yeah, so for the field trip, people can purchase tickets through our website, which is ikg-info.com, ikg-info.com. So they can go on our website and they can see all of the dates that we have available for the year. And, of course, if anything happens with our later field trips, that would be considered July through November, folks can still purchase tickets, and if for any reason the quarantine is extended or, you know, they have to reinstate it, then, of course, we'll refund folks their money. But they can access all of that information on our website. So they can also get information about the Acer Restoration Project. They can take a look at some of the work that we've done. That's actually one of the beautiful things that I like about my father and what he provides at the end of our excavation season. He does a presentation where he provides updates, gives you visuals so that you can see the progress that we've made over the course of that season, which normally is about 4 months. And, of course, if we are able to bring in more money, then we might be able to extend it. But on average, our season is about 4 months. So there's information about the Ace Restoration Project. We also do Wisdom Wednesday sessions, the third Wednesday of every night. Normally it's between 7 and 9, but, of course, because of the pandemic, we moved to an online platform. So we're going to do our best to adjust and still make sure we can give people information that they are definitely thirsty to receive.
Right. I have like two more questions for you, then I'm gonna pass it off to our special co-host.
Okay.
My next question is, in regards to your book, right? In regards to writing a book at a young age, in regards to writing a book at an age you are now, right? What have you learned from your first trip? What have you actually learned? You know what I'm saying? And how were you actually accepted into the Egyptian culture as a person from America?
You said, I'm sorry, what was that last part? You said, how have I been accepted?
I said, how were you accepted into the Egyptian, into the committed culture as a person from America? How did they accept you? How did they embrace you while over there?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So to go with your first question, and I'm actually glad you said that because I mentioned my first two books but didn't mention my latest book, which is called Reflections of My First Trip to Africa. So that book actually kind of speaks to your question. So having written my first book, it was published in 1990, that was basically 30 years ago. And so even though I've been to Egypt at least, 12 or 13 times since my first trip, I'm 37 now. And so being able to write this new book, I wanted to share, one, why I continue to travel to Egypt, but also I talk about what it is that I learned, because essentially, you know, I'm still trying to catch up to my dad. He's been to Egypt over 57 times. And just like him, every time I travel to Egypt, I'm always learning something new. I'm seeing something that I hadn't seen before. Or maybe in between, you know, the trips, I've, you know, done a little bit more studying. And so now when I go to Egypt and visit certain temples, I can see things through different eyes that I didn't have the knowledge or experience to see, you know, the previous year or other times that I visited. So it's always an opportunity to learn something new. And as far as, I guess, kind of adjusting to Egyptian culture, because essentially if anybody were to travel to Egypt, pretty much any part of Egypt, but the tourist spots are Cairo, which is the capital, Luxor and Aswan, which is further down south. But when you visit Egypt, it's very clear that Islam is the dominant culture. And so the practices, any practices that our ancestors implemented thousands of years ago, those types of things aren't being practiced today, because obviously those people are Muslim, so they don't even subscribe to some of the spiritual philosophies or ideas of Kemetic culture. And so, you know, having traveled there a number of times, you know, I've come across or even overheard Egyptians, and all of them have different perspectives or levels of understanding of what they essentially drive past or walk past every day. You know, if you can just imagine going out of your house every day and seeing a pyramid there right in front of your house, or a temple right down the street. So this is normal to them. But you have some Egyptians who will say, simply because their nationality is Egypt, that their ancestors built that. You'll have others who, some Egyptians who acknowledge that, you know, it might have been people who were not Muslim who were responsible for creating that culture. So not I'll just put it like this. The average Egyptian doesn't really know a lot about Egyptian history and culture, at least not from an African descendant perspective. They've still been kind of miseducated, like we all have, about the truth about that history. So when we go there as tourists, we are just that. We are tourists in their eyes. But when we travel as a study group, as the, what we refer to as the holy royal family, we actually become just that, become like a family, looking out for each other. On each of the study tours that I've been on for the past 13 years or so, it's always a small group of people who ultimately leave that study tour and go home, and they maintain contact. But we just create a space for us to learn together, to grow together, and we remember our purpose for being there. So the average person who goes to Egypt and takes a study tour, they're not going to learn that the Egyptians were black. They're going to learn, of course, that the Egyptians were Greek and Roman. And, of course, there is an aspect of Egyptian history in which the Greeks and the Romans came in and conquered Egypt. But the African origins of that history and culture are generally omitted. So when I go, you know, the Egyptian people in general, they live a very simple life. So they are very friendly. You know, you're always going to have somebody that wants to offer you tea. But at the end of the day, they know that we are tourists, and for many of them that have businesses, they know that this is an opportunity to try to, you know, get some money out of us. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's what anybody would do. If you own a business, you want to get customers. And so while some do connect with us because we are the same skin color, others, you know, are about their business. But, so I think that answered. Did that answer your question, your second question?
Yes, ma'am. I asked my second question. The last question, right, you know, could you tell us something about Atlantis that's not known or not you can't find? That's something that people don't know about.
I don't know what people do or don't know. There are dozens and dozens of books that have been written about Atlantis, but I guess what I've learned from my father.
I'm referring to you. I'm referring to you. The people don't know about you.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the actual place. Okay, I'm sorry. So ask your question one more time.
I said, tell us something about you that people don't know.
Tell you something about me that people don't know. Well, if they don't know, that means I probably don't want them to know.
You know, a lot of times things being people see biographies and see things on the internet, and, you know. But
yeah.
Something that people won't know when be able to Google.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, I think I would say that I'm pretty down to earth. You know, a lot of times when people meet me or even meet my father, they have like this kind of idea in our head of what we might be like. So oftentimes people don't expect us to be so down to earth. But I really enjoy meeting new people, and laughter, comedy is humor is one of the things that I try to incorporate into my life on a regular basis. Humor is good for the soul, so. One thing that sometimes people tell me I look so serious, and to some extent I know I can be a serious person, but I truly do like to laugh and like to have fun, so that might be something that people don't know about me.
Okay, I appreciate it. Again, I want to thank you for coming to our broadcast show. You know, the wisdom and understanding. Thank you for the work you did and what you continue to do in the future. Pass on to the co-host, Brother Kamasa. There you go, brother.
All right.
Hey, brother, how you doing? Hey,
brother
Kamasa. This is Atlantis. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing this evening?
I'm well. I'm not sure if you remember me back before I changed my name to Kamasi. I was going by Juan. We worked together at Front Elementary.
School?
Yes, at Freedom School.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, okay. Brother Bomani told me that he knew you or asked, you know, what our connection was. Okay, it's good to hear from you. How are
definitely.
You doing? What's going on with you? You graduated from done with school?
I'm currently in Jackson, Mississippi. I'm getting my master's degree in history at the moment, and hopefully I'll be able to pursue a PhD later on, possibly next year. But we're working hard.
Okay, excellent. That's good to hear. Very good to hear.
Definitely. But I just wanted to bring the conversation back around to the educational aspect of it, considering that's where I knew you from. So I know that there's a certain level of trauma that African children who attend white administered schools tend to experience based on the way, like, racism in education impacts how not only what we learn and what we think, but how we learn and how we think. And so for this reason, like, a lot of us leave school with illiteracy and a historical ignorance and an ignorance of self. And also, once we leave school, even if we did learn to read, we don't pick up a book anymore because that trauma still exists. We're afraid to actually continue to engage the educational process. How have you been able to combat that with your students and then other folks that you know in life who may be adults who kind of are afraid of education due to the racism that they experience from the educational process in their youth?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. That's an excellent question. So I guess I'll first answer that question as it relates to young people, just because I've had the most experience with that. But what I've learned, the first thing that you have to do is obviously get to know the kid, and obviously developing a meaningful relationship with your student, or at least that's important to me. I don't believe that I can educate a child until I can get to know them, have them get to know me, and understand what my purpose is for being there. So, for example, one of the things I started doing, I would probably say the last maybe five, six years of my teaching career, I would always start off my school year with just like when I would do like a formal introduction. So I would, you know, do a little PowerPoint and I would share my experience because I want them to understand, you know, the experience that I'm bringing to the table, the knowledge that I have to offer them, which is unlike, you know, many of the other teachers. And, of course, not to put them down, but every teacher is going to bring into the classroom their own experiences. So I just wanted to kind of whet their appetite and kind of get them excited. And so I've kind of learned how to get children excited about history. Sometimes I probably need to sit down and figure out how I'm actually able to do it, but it's just something that I've learned to do. Because I'll never forget one of my early years teaching in Maya Angelou. I was teaching sixth grade. And so, again, during this first week, you know, talked about Egypt, talked about Africa, talked about why history is so important and opportunities that are available to them if they're interested. And so afterwards, after I, you know, did my little, and I even brought in, you know, artifacts and things from Egypt to, you know, help them bring that experience alive. And I'll never forget one of my students said, Miss Francis, I need you to tell me what I need to pack because I'm going to Egypt. I got to start going shopping and get my list together. Like, I'm ready to go. I'm going with you to Egypt. And I would say, maybe a month or two later, but I remember that around parent-teacher conference, that student's mother came into my room. And, you know, this is my first time meeting a parent. And she said, Miss Browder, I don't know what you, and she wasn't, like, really angry, but she was more kind of, like, confused and trying to get some more information. But she was like, Miss Browder, my son came home talking about he's going to go to Africa. He has never even been out of this country, let alone out of the area, and he's talking about he wants to go to Egypt. And she was just like, what did you tell them? How did you get them so excited? And so I, you know, took the time to share a little bit of information. But all it takes, or what I've learned, is to get children excited. And so by just dropping jewels, and part of cultivating their minds, because all to a large extent, all of us have been socialized at some point, and it's only once we recognize that there are certain things that we need to do to take us down a certain path, then, you know, a person has to be serious enough and willing to commit themselves to that process. But for young people, I've learned to just kind of meet them where they are, see what they're interested in, and kind of use that to kind of merge it with the information that I'm trying to share. But part of it, a lot of it starts with individual conversations that I have with young people. And I know as a teacher, you know, in a formal classroom setting, it's kind of difficult to do that. But what I do to help young people open their minds and understand the importance of reading and help them to understand that they have to learn how to be self-sufficient, because the society is not necessarily designed for them to succeed. You know, we don't want to, you know, make them feel all depressed and make them feel like it's pointless, but we give them examples, and that's another thing, giving them examples of successful people. You know, a lot of young people that I work with at some of the inner cities, like middle school and high school students, you know, a lot of them wanted to be, or a majority of them wanted to be, you know, athletes or rappers, or they were just, you know, fine wanting to work at a restaurant. And, of course, you know, if you want to be an athlete, if you want to be a rapper, that's absolutely fine, but you should also have a plan B. And for many of these young people, the only reason they kind of limit their aspirations is because they haven't been exposed. So just exposing young people to new career ideas, opportunities, in which they can still be successful and maybe make just as much, if not even more money, you know, than being a rapper or being an athlete to some extent. So did that answer your question?
Definitely, definitely. And I really enjoyed the story about the child who wanted to go to Egypt, because it kind of seemed like he was seeing himself as being African as well.
Exactly. And part of what it is dispelling the myth, because a lot of the reasons that young people don't view Africa or African people, places, and things in a favorable light is because they've been taught that everything black is bad. Anything associated with Africa is negative. And so, you know, Carter G. Woodson talked about miseducation in his book. And what was that, 1933, The Miseducation of the Negro? And so I kind of see myself in terms of helping to resolve that issue is to help re-educate young people. So the only way we can re-educate them is to kind of see what they are, see what they already know. And unfortunately, a lot of the information that they have as it relates to themselves or their history with their potential as people is wrong. And so we have to identify what it is, kind of have a discussion about it. You know, where did you learn this information? How did you come to that conclusion? And once we kind of get to the source of it all, you know, getting them to understand, well, does that benefit you? So it's a lot of conversations that are required, and I often find myself doing that a lot in class. Of course, I have to make sure, you know, they get the work done, and I teach what I'm required to teach. But whenever I saw that kids would make, like, the most random, and I, you know, I was a history teacher. I taught D.C. history, world history, U.S. history, all of that. But whenever my students would make, like, a random connection to a history lesson, I would take advantage of that, because, one, they're, you know, making connections, but 9 times out of 10, they would make a connection to something that they're actually dealing with in real life. So young people don't have opportunities to have safe discussions about things that really matter with them. So I just wanted to I wanted to make sure my students knew that my classroom was a space where they can have those discussions, and that would allow me, again, to kind of gauge where they are, but also to plant seeds when necessary.
Definitely, definitely. I want to move to something that you said earlier in the discussion, when you were talking about how the Egyptians embraced you and your family when you went to the country. And you mentioned that sometimes they see you as a tourist, but I'm kind of the belief that really no African is an alien in Africa. Like, no matter what part you're in, if you are descendant of Africa, you belong there. So with you kind of being somebody who's been to Egypt and Gambia and Ghana and Senegal, what made you come back? Because a lot of us would have went there and just been like, I want to stay forever. What's keeping you in America?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of things that I would say are keeping me here, but and also just to kind of go back to part of your statement. So even though some of those Egyptians, some of the Egyptians I encountered might have seen us as, you know, a tourist or a dollar sign, there were definitely just as many more Egyptians who also, like, really just tried to connect with us just simply just because of our skin color. You know, they knew we were Americans. They knew that we didn't practice their religion, but they were just eager to practice their English and just connect with us because we had the same color, same skin color. So having traveled to Egypt, specifically Luxor, and having stayed there, and, you know, when I'm working at the excavation site, it's almost like I'm kind of living with the locals. So I've kind of experienced what that's like on a smaller scale to live there. The longest that I've ever stayed in Egypt was a month. And I definitely would not dismiss the idea of moving outside of the States permanently. Now, is that something that I'm prepared to do right now at this moment? I can't say that I am, but I do recognize that this country is going to hell. And, you know, when it hits the ceiling, we do need to be prepared to move to relocate. And so I'm fortunate, at least through my father, to know people who have land over in Ghana, which is one place that I would consider moving. That would be an option. So basically, to answer your question, it's definitely something I'm open to, but I would have to, you know, if I'm going to be moving on a permanent basis, that's something that I want to prepare to do. I don't want to just up and go just for the sake of it. Because at the same time, and you'll hear many of our people argue about this. Some people say that this isn't our country. But my response to that is, granted, our history in this country is not, if anything, it should be more embarrassing for the people who enslaved us. I'm not embarrassed because my ancestors might have been enslaved, because I know that that was forced upon them. But just knowing how our ancestors contributed to this country is just as much ours as anybody else. But it just means that if we choose to stay in this country, we know what we're dealing with. The unfortunate reality is that racism and white supremacy is everywhere. There might be different degrees of it depending on where you go. But there's a lot of things that I would really have to consider and prepare for when that time came to make the move.
Definitely. I think that's a very acute insight and something that we're all dealing with, especially during the time of this pandemic, where we are starting to really understand that we're going to be impacted more than everybody else anytime anything bad happens in this country. So in regards to the last question and also just understanding the era that we're in, what's going on in the country and around the world, and also based on, like, your education and everything that you've observed from your travels and your studies, what's something that has really opened your eyes based on what you know and how this pandemic is playing out? And do you think that there could be anything, a positive, to come out of this for African people?
Well, I'll say this. First of all, there is a lot of information, that's been put out about what's going on and so many different theories. And I was having a conversation with my dad about this the other day because I know for a fact that there are a lot of people who are putting out false information And some people like to call it fake news, whatever you want to call it. But fake news does exist, so we have to be real about that. I just lost my train of thought. All right. Okay, repeat that question again.
You were talking about the fake news. I was asking about anything that you that may have opened your eyes in regards to, like, the world.
Okay.
In the state it is now.
Yeah. And so, see, another thing is that there's a lot more research that I would have to do because much of the information that I've received is what people are just what people are saying. Now, granted, some of these people have the experience and background to speak authoritatively about you know, what's going on. But I'll just, you know, because some things I would prefer not to speak about on this particular platform. But I'll just say that that there are definitely things going on that people are not aware about. And, you know, if you're interested, if a person is interested in trying to find out what that is, so be it. But there are certain plans that, to some extent, are inevitable. And we can only do what we can do to survive and thrive the best that we can. But I do see that our people can come out of this, or we can find a way to benefit from this. But it's really the state of mind that's going to determine how you take advantage of this time. Of course, all of our people have been hit. When I'm speaking for our, you know, our people, African American people, people have been affected differently, and so there are some people who have taken advantage of this time to now develop relationships, closer relationships with their children, with their family, actually spending time with their family. So I truly hope that families will come out stronger when this all comes to an end. I know that a lot of people have been using these last 5 weeks to learn, to study, to just read. So a lot of our people will come out a little bit more knowledgeable than they were before this pandemic started. I think a lot of people, for a lot of our people, this is a wake-up call that there are certain crises that occur naturally and others that may not occur naturally. But the question is, how prepared are we? And I was just talking to my dad the other day, telling him, I was going to create this little survival kit, you know, that could be relevant for any type of natural disaster. We have to, we got 5 minutes, we got to get out of here. You know, we need to have everything ready if we need to leave, or even if we're locked in the house and there's no power, no running water, you know, being prepared. So I do think that there are a lot more of our people who will maybe take emergency preparedness a little bit more seriously. I definitely will, not to say this, just to kind of wrap up my response. So those are positive things that I think will come out of it, but one of my biggest concerns, which is actually something negative, is how these students are going to recover from 5 weeks of quote-unquote distant learning. I've had the opportunity to spend some time with my nephew, who is in seventh grade, and so I'm, you know, helping him out with his work, but I'm kind of seeing how he has to navigate the system. And, you know, essentially what they're doing is designed for students who are independent learners, who don't need somebody down their back or, you know, kind of guiding them through the process. But I can just imagine how many students are struggling, how many students have lost motivation, even though this essentially is an opportunity to get an easy A. All you got to do is log into your Zoom meetings or, you know, submit the work. So to a large extent, I can see how students are overwhelmed because now they have to organize their schedule. They have to make sure that they're, you know, keeping up the schedule so that they can log in and check in their assignments. So it's a lot on them, and our young people were not prepared for this transition. So I do hope that one thing will come out of this, that school systems will have a better contingency plan to educate young people. I mean, I don't know how well you can, how the education, how effective it will be, or how quality of an education you could provide with distant learning, because many of the African-American students I work with, they require in-person learning. And I've had experience working at a high school that actually implemented an online learning platform, which made my position go from the head teacher to now an assistant and just waiting for students to ask for help. So I've actually seen students in that type of environment, which is what is kind of going on a mass scale. And so I just hope that schools will be prepared to really go hard in the fall, because a lot of students will be behind. We already know about summer retention. You know, just a couple of months the kids are out of school, they lose a lot of what they've learned. So just for them to have been out this long is very unfortunate. And I just hope that parents don't depend completely on the school system. I hope they understand that, you know, they're now going to have to step up, because I promise you, this pandemic has revealed a lot of things. A lot of parents have learned that their children can't read. And I bet you some children have learned that their parents can't read. So it's a struggle for a lot of people, and I just hope folks now see how serious education is and that it's not easy. Teachers have to do a lot. You saw with Freedom School, you know, and that was just for 6 weeks, but it's a lot to try to engage young people who have been socialized, like you said, to not want to read or to not like history. But it's a process that we have to engage in, because if we don't do it, who's going to do it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Hopefully we can come out of this with at least a little more respect for haters in the educational process. I want to pass it back to Brother Bomani, if you don't mind.
Okay. And tell me, what is your new name again? Because I want to make sure I get it right.
Kamasi Amin.
Kamasi, is it K-A-M-A-S-I?
K-U-M-A-S-I.
Okay, Kumasi. All right, excellent.
Yeah.
All right, well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I'm really happy to hear that you're doing well and you're moving forward with your education and pursuing your goals. So I wish you, definitely wish you the best in that journey, brother.
Thank you so much.
All right, you're welcome.
Okay, I appreciate it. Yeah, so we got a few minutes left. You got any final thoughts for the last few minutes?
Final thoughts. Well, for those who are listening,
some information and things.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last part.
Like, you want to leave us some information, like some website information or information about any documents and things that you've been involved with, you know, you leave us information.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who are interested in checking out my publications, either three of my publications, Reflections of My First Trip to Africa, Africa on My Mind. Actually, so my very first book that I published is no longer in print, but we are preparing to make it available online. But my second and my third book are available. Folks can check it out. They can purchase it through our website, which is ikg-info.com. Again, ikg-info.com. So check out our website for our publications, also to get information about the ASA Restoration Project, how they can support or get involved. And if anybody ever comes to D.C. once this lockdown is raised, then they can go on one of our Egypt or the Potomac field trips. They are the first Saturday of every month up until November. And on the first Saturday of the month, we have two field trips, one at 10 a.m. and one at 2 p.m. But they can go on a website to get more information. And if they are interested and they like the work that we do, they can sign up to be on our listserv so that they can get information about any upcoming activities. So, again, the website is ikg-info.com. Oh, and also, you know what? I will say this really quickly. I forgot to mention the CIP program, a cultural imperative program. We've moved into the second year of this program, which was originally created by my father and a colleague of his, Deborah Watkins, who's out in California, San Jose. And essentially they started working with high school students in San Jose, and they were reading my father's book, From the Broader File, Volume 1, 22 Essays on the African-American Experience. And so the early part of that program, students would read the book, have discussion, and then write reflection papers. And so when I came on board with CIP as the national director, I used my experience as an educator to help develop a curriculum. And so I essentially developed a curriculum based on my father's first book, From the Broader File, and we've been able to use that as a part of our cultural imperative program. And so if there's anybody who's interested in this program, we've seen it be more successful within the school system, particularly because they have access to the students, they have access to resources. But this is something that you can bring to your school. It's a Saturday program. They meet one Saturday a month for about 3.5 hours. And they will read select articles and from the broader file and complete activities that are part of the curriculum. So we're actually preparing for our 2021 season. Now, this program is primarily targeted towards high school students, and we're actually working on a curriculum to have a CIP for elementary and middle school students, so that'll be in a pipeline. But if there's anybody who wants to bring this program to their city, and they understand that there's a need for it, they can also get information about our CIP on our website, ikg-info.com.
Okay. You have anything else for us? Anything else? Any kind of final thoughts, or that's it?
Well, unless you want to ask any more questions, I've got about maybe 10 more minutes.
Okay, you got about 10 more minutes. Hold on. Let me open the line up for another person. Then.
Yeah, okay. You
got about 10 more minutes. I have a question. Okay. Elder Mama Connie, your line is open.
Is this Mama Tina? Is this, I'm sorry, I thought the name said Mama Kina or Kina?
Mama Condi.
Oh, Condi. Greetings, Mama. How you doing?
I'm doing. Thank you for asking. I have to say this to you, sweetie.
Yes.
I am so proud of you. You don't know me personally. I know your dad. And
mm-hmm.
your dad met me through my brother.
Okay.
My brother and I co-founded a theater company, Soul in Motion Players.
Okay.
And my brother wrote a script, and I revised it to fit the people out here in Ohio where I am. My brother's in the D.C. area.
Okay.
What is your brother's name? Kambui Niahuma, or Go Friend. And
okay.
he wrote a script, and in the script, there's a brother who's homeless. And this homeless brother is repulsive to people.
Hmm.
In my revision, I made the homeless person me. And I'm obnoxious. I rubbed garlic and gums of asafoetida all over my clothing. I stunk. And I went to the thrift store and bought all these raggedy clothes, and I got, actually, I did such a good job, they put me out of the theater once. They didn't realize I was one of the performers.
Oh, wow.
But the whole thing was, these homeless people were brilliant. They knew all the information in your dad's book. And the play was called We Are Africa. By the time we shared all that information, the audience had a whole different view about Africa and homeless people. And all the information that your dad shared, we made it into the monologues and dialogues in the script. And he really surprised me because he came out here to Ohio, and I was sitting in the front row right near where he had his table set up, and I asked one of the young sisters who was with me, because when he came to speak, I brought about 6 to 10 young people with me.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And I asked one of the young people to approach him and ask him if he knew my brother. And he came over and he got down on one knee. He took
Uh-oh.
My breath away. He took my breath away. And he said, "Yes, ma'am, elder, I know your brother." And he said, "I know you." He said, "You just don't know I know you, but I know you too." And we hugged, and it was just beautiful. I enjoyed his presentation. I remember him talking about his child and her first book, and I've been hearing about you since you were knee-high to a duck. And so I'm just excited to see, you know, where you are in your life journey. And I am so proud of you. I'm one of those elders who watch you from afar. Young people, y'all got to be clear about what you're doing and be careful, because you never know who's watching.
Absolutely.
You just never know. And I just had to smile, and you take me down memory lane. With the work that you do, I'm a part of the independent African school system. I'm Pan-African, and we've been doing schools since the 60s, independent African centered schools. We didn't start from the civil rights movement. We started from the Pan-Africanist movement, and I was one of the co-founders of 5 independent African centered schools, K through 12, especially out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And so I
really appreciate
a question for me that I don't know to ask you.
I'm sorry, you say that one more time?
Answer a question for me that I don't know I should ask you.
I've never been asked that. Answer a question that you don't know. Well, I can share. A lot of people ask me, or actually a handful of people have asked me about the path that I'm taking. If this is something that my father has forced me to do, is this something that I really want to do? Am I passionate about it? And that question is something that I've, thought about a lot over the years, especially as I've gotten older and I've understood the importance of legacy. And, of course, now that I'm an adult, I can really have a greater appreciation for the work that my father has done over the years and what he continues to do, working so hard to do. So I guess there was a time in which I doubted, you know, whether or not I should continue this path. And I was much younger, actually
when I was in college, high school, going into college, and I wasn't sure if this was the path that I wanted to take. I knew, you know, I had an idea it was important, and, you know, people like you who have seen me grow over the years would always, you know, tell me to keep up the good work, but I guess I still needed to have that answer for myself. And it wasn't until I went away to college that I actually learned to develop an even greater sense of appreciation for my father's work. That was my first time, you know, being away from home for an extended period of time. And I'll never forget the first couple of times I had met, you know, I started off at Hampton University in Virginia, and the first couple of times I would meet, and they were generally students at the campus, and I would meet them and tell them my name, and they would say, "Oh, you're Anthony Browder's daughter?" And I would look at them like, "Yes, I am." And they would just, you know, get so excited about, you know, meeting me and my father being Tony Browder. And it wasn't until that happened, you know, a few times that I just really, I just felt a sense of I guess I definitely was happy. It was a good feeling. I don't know if happy is the best word, but I was so intrigued as to how excited people were when they talked about my dad and his work, and they had never met him. You know, maybe they had read his book or seen a lecture, but it told me that their lives had been changed as a result of reading my father's book. And so that really kind of changed my perspective or helped to influence me in some way because, you know, people who know me know that I don't necessarily like to be in the spotlight unless I have to. I'm real kind of laid back. I'm, you know, in the cut, you know, kind of behind the scenes like Ella Baker. But I recognize that I got to a point where I realized that I wanted to have that same impact on people. I wanted to inspire people. You know, I already had an interest in education, so I knew I was going to be educating people some way or some form. But just how my father is able to inspire people, and that was something that I've always admired, him having the ability to do that through his work. And through his presentations. And so that was the period of time in which I began to kind of come full circle and feel more, I guess, comfortable. I can't describe the best word, but I just became more open to embracing this idea of this being the path that I'm supposed to walk. And, of course, it still took some more time for me to learn and grow. But I truly believe that I believe in reincarnation. We come back to this physical plane many times so that we can learn lessons. And so I know that I have a karmic connection with my father. So I know it's no accident that he's my father in this particular time. So I believe, well, I feel very strongly that there's a reason why I was born into this life and have had the experiences that I've had, and now that I'm able to really appreciate the wealth of things that my father has done, I feel that I don't even know if I could live with myself if I allowed his work to just kind of go in vain, if I weren't able to continue his legacy and continue my legacy as well. So that's something that I don't talk about too often, just in terms of my journey to really come in to accept part of my purpose. And that part of my purpose might change or evolve over time, which I expect. But I can say confidently that I know that this is my path. And so I know that on a personal level, there are things that I need to do so that I can make sure that I can continue this journey and continue to grow and teach others. So was that a good answer to a question that you don't know how to ask?
Darapo. Well done.
Thank you.
I yield.
Thank you, and I appreciate your kind words. My father is listening as well, so I'm sure he'll be happy to hear you sharing. I haven't seen him some years ago.
Oh, fantastic. Bless y'all both. Bless you both. Bomani,
right.
I yield.
Okay. At a moment, kind of free to land. Yeah, you have any final thoughts? You having a final thought for the listener, Atlantis?
Do we have any other questions? We can take one or two more questions. I don't mind.
Okay. Hold on. Let me see. Line 01570. You have a question or comment for the caller? Your line is open. 901-570. Your line is open. Okay, go ahead.
Frida Land. Oh.
Frida Land.
Frida Land, by my eye. I don't necessarily have any questions, yet I have most definitely been enjoying the whole conversation going on. You're doing magnificent things. All I can say is just keep up, keep going, keep listening to your heart, keep listening to your higher self, so you know what the next level that you're going to take it. And I yield.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and you know, I do feel that in spite of what we accomplished, we could all use a little bit of motivation and encouragement, and it's always good to know, and especially even more so good to hear when people, you know, share that they appreciate our work, because it truly motivates me to continue doing what I'm doing. So I truly appreciate that.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so very much. Oh yeah, I forgot. I went to Hampton too. I went to Hampton. Yes.
Okay, I was there for about three and a half years, 2000 to 2004, and then I transferred to Bowie State University in Maryland, where I graduated.
Got you. I was there from 99 to 2002.
Okay, so we might have come across each other.
I actually remember your father doing the lecture there in one of the halls. I remember that.
Okay, yeah, so that probably was before I went there. But I don't think he ever did. I had some teachers that used his, some professors who used his book, Now Valley, for their class, but I don't remember him coming while I was there. Okay, well, that's good. All right, fellow Hamptonians.
Yes.
All right. It's a pleasure meeting you, and thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Brother Bomani, this is Mama Aya. May I speak?
Hold up. Yeah. Go ahead, Mama Aya. Go ahead.
I had a wonderful time listening to you. Yes, and I want to say free the land and bless your father and bless your journey. Remember, these are the times that we are transforming ourselves, because we are coming into who we say we're supposed to be. So we believe in the laws of Ma'at.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And we believe in everything that should not be what we call it, an abomination to the earth, cannot stand in the face of all these, the history and the legacy of our people. And we want you to just continue to uplift our children and tell them that they have a purpose, that they are to continue a legacy of freedom and justice, you know, standing on principles. And that's your job, and I bless you for it and your father, because when the people know who they are, they know what their purpose is. So you are doing wonderful, and I thank you.
Right, thank you so much. No, you definitely spoke to something I don't think I mentioned, but it's certainly important, which is having young people understand their responsibility for continuing the work that our ancestors have laid the ground for. So, yeah, there's a lot of work we have to do, and we can certainly all play our part. But we can, you know, liberate our people one mind at a time. So the more people we have working together, we can reach more of our people. So definitely thank you for that comment.
Okay. We appreciate your Mama Ayo and Samat. Okay. what's your time? What you got? You got more for another question or what?
Yeah, we can do one more question. That's cool.
Okay. Well, okay, I'm gonna open up Kamasha line again. Okay. Yeah, Kamasha line open, man, for one more question.
Man, I don't know if I have another question at the moment.
Come on, Kamasha, I know you got another question. I don't think I've ever told you this, but I have worked with a lot of Freedom School SLIs, and you by far are one of the most impressive, particularly because of your intellect and how you think on a whole nother level. So I know you can come up with another question for me. I know you can. I know you got it.
All right. Well, I think I actually very appreciate that a lot. And to be honest, I guess the best, not really a question, but more so a comment of what you were just speaking about in terms of how younger folks have to take up the mantle, take up the charge of continuing the work that the ancestors laid down for us. You're not necessarily an elder, but you are a respected OG in the game so far with all the work you've accomplished. What do you recommend to younger folks who would like to get involved in this type of work? Specifically, what do you tell your students, or what do you tell just anybody who looks up to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that, and I still, you know, I compare myself to, you know, my dad and, you know, the Patricia Newtons and Dr. Clark, so I'm looking up to them. They're my standard, so I still feel like I have a ways to go, but I certainly appreciate that, and I do. My father does have to remind me from time to time that, you know, many of the experiences that I've had, you know, that's kind of my norm, and I guess sometimes I might take that for granted, because I still feel like there's so much more that I have to learn, and it doesn't seem like there's enough hours in a day. But I would first encourage our people in general, but especially young people, to read more. I don't necessarily have all of the stats in front of me, but just, you know, doing research to understand how reading strengthens the brain, and how it helps us grow on a variety of levels, but just encouraging young people to read more. And so I understand that, you know, some of our kids' attention spans varies, or if they naturally aren't interested in reading, then I encourage them to start with something that is of interest to them. So if they like working on cars, you know, read, check out some magazines about you know, automobiles, or, you know, whatever their interest is, or whether it's a comic book, it doesn't have to be a formal, you know, textbook or book that we think of. There's so much information out there. And so between encouraging young people to read and read things that they're interested in, also encouraging them to search for things that are out there, because a lot of times, you know, it's difficult to tell a child to search for something. It may be difficult to say search this or search that, but sometimes when you're kind of on the journey of enlightenment, as you're finding different things, it's like certain doors will open that you may not have expected to open for you. So it's just simply starting on the path of enlightenment and just understanding that life is a learning process. You know, this is the school of life. So, you know, a lot of young people are so anxious to be done with school because they're tired of reading and writing. But again, it's because they've been conditioned to not understand the benefit of reading and writing. So, yeah, and then even when it comes to writing, you know, a lot of our young people are talented lyricists, so they like to write poems, so encouraging young people to write, because nowadays with technology, it's like the cell phone is another appendage. You know, it's literally a part of our body, and kids are glued to it, and I get it because they were born in this age, but my greatest fear is that technology is going to cause our people to lose communication, not communicate as much as we should, and not engage in real human interaction. So, you know, I always encourage young people to try to reduce, minimize the amount of time that they're spending on social media, because you spend time looking at folks, other people's business, what they're cooking, where they're going. Next thing you know, you spent 2 hours looking at everybody else's stuff, but what are you doing for yourself? You know, how is that going to benefit you? Maybe it might inspire you to do something new. That's one thing. But we just have to learn to use our time more productively and just be responsible. So, yeah, I think that's what I would encourage our people to do, to read more, to write more, even if it means instead of reading a book, if you prefer to read on your tablet or your Kindle. But there's so many different ways that we can access information, and I want young people to understand what's at their fingertips and to truly take advantage of it. Because when I was young, you know, we didn't have this much freedom or access to information as we do now. So, you know, anything, I tell young people, literally anything that you want to learn is written in a book. And so if young people aren't at the point where they know what they want to do in life, you know, you have to explore. So that's primarily what I would encourage young people to do. And I kind of cross a lot of different areas because, you know, reading is important, writing is important, but also our health, our mental health, our physical health. So I often have a lot of conversations with young people about, you know, their diet, what they're eating. The last school that I worked, you know, especially my first period class, I'd have kids coming in with the sodas, with the Flamin' Hot Cheetos and all the other stuff with the red dye. And, like, this is literally their breakfast. And so I would, you know, do something as simple as, you know, because, you know, I talked to you earlier, Kamasi, about relationships. And so I had such a good enough relationship with many of my students that when they did come in, you're not going to eat that. And I often started bringing in fruit or might let them, you know, if they were late, go down to the cafeteria and get some food. But I will hold that, you know, because I'm not going to allow you in my presence to poison yourself. If that's what you choose to do on your own time, that's your choice. But while I have control over it, I'm going to do something because I care. So I would, you know, even break down, I talk to or introduce to students a lot about etymology, looking words up, finding the origin of words. You know, when we look at the word breakfast, what does it mean? Breaking your fast. So I would talk to students about what does it mean to fast? What is the purpose of fasting? And just helping them understand that the first thing that they put in their body should be something that is healthy, not junk food. Why do they call it junk food? Because it's trash. What do you do with trash? You throw it out. It rots. It does no good. So just helping kids understand the basics. Yes, that's some of the things that I would do and encourage our young people to do, to ask questions. Don't just accept things that they are. And you don't have to be disrespectful when you disagree with something, but you have to learn how to ask the right questions so that you can get the right response.
Okay. Definitely. I thank you for that. I feel like the biggest thing that I got from that was the communication aspect of it, intergenerational communication. I feel like a lot of times young people, we just think that we're out here on our own. And, you know, we may respond emotionally, and after that, we don't know what to do beyond that, so we're confused, and so we just stop moving. And the reading more, the writing more, the discussions of health, all of that is a very communicative process that just, like, allows us to really, really keep going as a nation, as a people. So I appreciate that.
And I'm sure you definitely experienced that and observed that through Freedom School, because that was one of the biggest things with their motto, is having this intergenerational interaction between the college students and the young people that they're serving. So that's something that I also learned from Freedom School. Because Freedom School really helped me to be successful in the classroom. I don't know what kind of I'm sure I would still be a pretty good teacher, but I know I wouldn't be as great of a teacher had I not had the experience with Freedom School and just bringing those tools into the classroom. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Brother Bomani.
Yes, sir. Okay. appreciate it, Brother Warren. Okay. Yes, no. Yeah, you basically signed up. That's what you found out. You basically gave to find out.
Absolutely. But I definitely appreciated this, and I enjoyed having Brother Kumasi as a part of this discussion. It was a surprise, but definitely a good surprise. It was good to hear from him and good to speak to some of the listeners. So I definitely enjoyed myself and appreciate the opportunity to be on GJU Radio.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate you coming to our broadcast again to show you another with understanding. You know, I appreciate the work you did and work you committed in the future. And for all the listeners, if you have any loved ones, associate, comrades, or former relative behind enemy line incarcerated, look at our website with www.jordanuniversity.com. Again, www.jordanuniversity.com. Another thing, if you haven't seen the documentary Out of Darkness, with Lancer Brothers on it, y'all need to check the documentary out. It's on Amazon Prime. I need to check the documentary out. It's an excellent documentary.
Yes, thank you for that. I forgot to mention. All right, you take care, brother. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, ma'am. Peace.
To independence now.
Yeah, they say those who do not move do not feel the change, but the African people aware of the pain, aware of the game, invader deception, black presidents who are white man extensions, people from Cape to Cairo rebel, cause fake independence and ongoing hell, colonial ties still keep them chained, the richest continents getting robbed again, the IMF and World Bank criminal schemes, what about reparations? To me it seems that every metropole from Amsterdam to Paris and Brussels was built with the hands of African labor, a slave relation, developing Europe at expense of the nation. But Africans rebel from the first conquest till flag independence at last accomplished.
Il y en a qui demandent la vie de tous les impérialistes. L'impérialiste, regardez dans vos assiettes quand vous mangez les grains de riz, de maïs, de mil importés. C'est ça l'impérialisme. N'allez pas plus loin.
Yeah. Hey yo, the spirit of Lumumba lives on in Congo, like Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. Samora Michelle, it was Viva Frelimo, but Mozambique still fighting for freedom. Why did these three who dare to invent the future then clash to the fullest extent with the colonizers? If we open eyes, if we can see the rich whites, we're scared of rising African power, real independence, of people's politics, anti-capitalist. So they stifle their growth in every way, so that South Africa looks colonized today. For any flaws of Mugabe, that ain't what they hate. Zimbabwe's not a colony, make no mistake. Look at AFRICOM, the African command. That's the US and a puppet shaking each other's hands. Divide and conquer is a hell of a tactic. They blame Africa for relations that backward. The whole basis was plunder from outside. Rwanda, Uganda, Sudan's divides. Pushing forward war for precious coal sand. So cell phones and PCs are sold in lands where people don't know how they were constructed. Your Windows now functions from a child's destruction.